This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Carolyn Osorio, who's in for Carlene this morning. We're just hearing now about another close call in the South China Sea between an American warship and a Chinese destroyer. The two came within 45 yards of each other before the American ship veered off. Let's find out what's going on. Here's CBS military analyst and retired Army Major Mike Lyons. This seems to be happening on a regular basis now. First of all, tell me about the mission that the American ship was on. It's called a Freedom of Navigation operation.
Well, the U.S. Navy keeps the shipping lanes open in the South China Sea for our allies and friends there. Some of them include the Philippines, Australians, and believe it or not, Vietnamese. And those carriers have got to get through and get their goods and services through. The Chinese ships have a tendency to stop and board them and try to create problems for them as they try to move their goods throughout that location. In this particular situation, the Chinese are claiming land responsibility or territorial rights in one of those areas where they've built up military assets on what were atolls before that now they claim have a greater allowance for them in order to call it their own territorial waters.
So that's been their strategy. They create these artificial islands and then they claim those offshore limits that all countries are allowed to claim?
Right. Think of like a lily pad where you drop, you know, kind of lily pads out into the ocean. And it's going to force these countries to like navigate now through certain areas, whereas before they could just literally go straight through. The Chinese have expanded areas literally in the middle of the South China Sea that's causing them to claim that they have territorial rights over.
And is there some central authority that determines who's right on that issue?
Right. The world has navigational treaties, and all nations agree that 11 miles off their shore are considered territorial rights to that specific country. So the United States would consider that 11 miles off of mainland China. It would not consider these new claimed areas as that as such. Now, there are disputed islands that do exist about different countries, but fundamentally, these are new additions to what that rule would be.
So I'm guessing that their long-term strategy is to create enough lily pads, as you put it, so that those 11-mile circles intersect and it's all theirs.
Yeah, that's basically it. And as they, again, pump sand in, build up certain areas, and or else cause ships to, you know, navigate way around them and go off way off course. And so the United States Navy has built up their presence there to make sure that those ships can pass safely through those areas, kind of a point A to point B, as opposed to meandering around the South China Sea.
Well, if the country can do that, why don't we just build our own islands? We can build islands too, can't we?
We can. It's just, here we go. It gets back to what's not the intent or the spirit of what the agreement is. And for the Chinese to take it this far is something we just haven't seen before with the resources they have. Because, again, they've not built condos on these places. They're not vacation sites. They're literally have missile silos and other things, other military assets, and anti-ship assets is what the Navy's concerned about.
Lately, I thought that the president and President Xi were the best of friends, but suddenly you've got this going on, and you also have China taking a hard line on trade talks. So where is this headed?
Well, you had Mike Pence yesterday also speak at the Hudson Institute in Washington with what appears to be a Cold War that's now starting between us and the Chinese, it clearly with trade as the forefront there, not with this potential nuclear holocaust that could take place between our two countries, but it blaming the Chinese for involvement in the elections. And it looks like the theme is the Chinese don't like Donald Trump as a president. He's been too disruptive. He's not been additive to what the Chinese feel has been a good relationship. And so I think it's going to continue to get chilly for a while.
Let me ask you this. How we're bringing up human rights, talking about Mike Pence's speech. He talked about the creation of an unparalleled surveillance state of brutally repressing religious minorities, oppressing countries, et cetera, et cetera. This sounds like a human rights campaign, which I thought the president was going to avoid.
Well, I think a lot of this came from the vice president himself, given, you know, kind of the factions inside the Trump administration that want to take a hard line towards, you know, conservative views. And he feels that by bringing up this anti-Muslim rhetoric, for example, he feels that the Chinese will eliminate that religion from its boundary at some point. I think it gets back to Judeo-Christian values that Mike Pence has, that he's espoused his entire political career.
Now, what do you mean the anti-Islam rhetoric? Who's preaching anti-Islam?
The Chinese are. The Chinese, Mike Pence claims that within a few years that there will be no Muslim, the Muslim faith will have left completely of the Chinese mainland.
So we're going to stick up for them is what he's saying.
Yeah, exactly right. He's going to we're going to stick up for them. We're going to stick up for religious rights and religious freedoms and the like. And again, you get the Secretary of State on that. You get John Bolton on that. They're right behind him. They're going after these countries that don't follow in line with what we consider U.S. Human rights to be. Similar to what the Obama administration talked about, just didn't do anything about.
Yeah. All right. One more thing. I know that you've taken a stand on artificial intelligence in terms of how it would be used in warfare, that you must never surrender the decision to fire a weapon to some kind of computer software. But there's a piece in The Washington Post today talking about how the Defense Department has opened a pretty substantial research program involving artificial intelligence. The reason they're doing it in-house is because apparently there was a strike among Google workers who didn't want to be seen as cooperating in any kind of use of artificial intelligence technology in warfare.
Right. So what's happening, we're losing the artificial intelligence game as the Chinese, their government invests money specifically in companies to do that. The United States still doesn't do that. It won't put its finger on the scale, so to speak, in these public companies. So the leaders like Microsoft, Google, Apple, IBM have got to do it all themselves. But DARPA, that's the research agency of the Army in particular, they're going to spend anywhere from $3 to $4 billion over the next few years, funnel that down to these lower level companies that are startups. What the intelligence, what the artificial intelligence community needs is its moonshot. It needs its 10-year level of investment, similar to the way that man went to the moon, created all of those ancillary products that were good for humankind, but also will be able to match what the Chinese are doing when it comes to artificial intelligence, in particular when it comes to defensive systems that will make decisions defensively while combat is going on.
So like what? I mean, how would that work?
Well, the decision, for example, inbound rockets or certain things that will trigger and be do a better job of machines talking to machines with regard to overall defense. I think a lot of this actually translates even further up into the atmosphere. This is in some ways the visionary aspect of what the president is talking about wars that could take place in the atmosphere against our satellites. That those are clearly decisions that can be made by machines when they feel that they're being made under attack. I think the artificial intelligence at the close-in battle, at the tactical level, still will remain much more of a human decision.
CBS military analyst and retired Army Major Mike Lyons. The bottom line is that Judge Brett Kavanaugh's time as a Supreme Court nominee will come to an end one way or the other by tomorrow night. He could end up being a judge by tomorrow. We called up CBS News congressional correspondent Nancy Cordes inside a noisy Senate building because it looks to me like the Democrats gambled and lost on this one.
Well, it's hard to say because there are still these four undecideds, and I just got off the phone with an aide to Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia a short time ago. He still doesn't know which way his boss is going to go, even though we've got a procedural vote coming up in very short order that will likely tip his hand one way or the other. He says Manchin is heading back one more time to that secure room this morning to read through the rest of the FBI report that he didn't get to yesterday before he makes up his mind. But Republicans are getting some pretty positive signs from a couple of the undecideds on their side of the aisle. You had Jeff Flake of Arizona and Susan Collins of Maine say yesterday that they thought that the FBI report was very thorough. Flake even said that it did not corroborate any of Christine Blasey Ford's allegations, and that was a sign to Republicans that they don't side with Democrats who have been arguing that this report was incomplete because agents did not interview Blasey Ford or Kavanaugh themselves, along with potentially a couple dozen other people that Blasey Ford and another alleged victim, Deborah Ramirez, had put forward as potential corroborating witnesses.
Right. And we've gone 2 days now with no new accusations. And I hear that George W. Bush is going to lobby on behalf of Kavanaugh?
Has been reaching out to some of these senators, urging Republicans who had already made up their minds to stay strong, trying to put a thumb on the scale for Kavanaugh with those who are still undecided. The lobbying effort has been really ferocious. And it isn't just luminaries and White House officials. I mean, you saw an entire building here at the Capitol filled with hundreds, if not thousands, of protesters yesterday unfurling huge banners in support of Christine Blasey Ford. 300 of them were arrested. We just heard that there are more protesters outside of the home of the Senate's Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, this morning. They are drinking out of red Solo cups and chanting, "I like beer," sort of a mockery of what Kavanaugh had to say last week in his confirmation hearings. I don't think that's going to work on the Senate's Republican leader. He's pretty firmly in the Kavanaugh camp. But interest groups, Republican and Democratic leaders are all leaving no stone unturned, because really the balance of the Supreme Court is at stake here, potentially for a generation. So this is incredibly high stakes.
Right. Well, I mean, I understand the opposition to him based on his conservative principles, but it strikes me that parts of this whole episode came precariously close to guilty until proven innocent. I mean, was there any sense that, as compelling as Dr. Ford's story was, at some point you have to have objective corroboration?
Well, you know, the argument the Democrats made was, how often is it when someone is sexually assaulted that there's someone else to witness it and can say, yes, I saw that? The best that they said Blasey Ford could do was to provide witnesses who she had told about this alleged sexual assault either before Kavanaugh was nominated this year or in previous years. You know, of course, it is really taking people's word for it. And there's no question that this has been such a politically heated process, with senators on both sides believing whoever they want to believe, you know, is going to share their point of view, that it was always going to be very difficult to try to get to some type of objective truth. And there's no question that we saw folks crossing the line on both sides and that made up their mind who they were going to believe. Well before we had heard from either one of them. I think that's really been a feature of this entire debate, is that you've got senators on both sides almost looking at their own sets of facts. You had Republicans and Democrats, for example, Dave, going into that secure room yesterday to read this FBI report. Republicans came out and said, well, it didn't corroborate anything. Democrats came out and said, that's absolutely not true. We saw a lot to be troubled by in that report. So, you know, it's very difficult to try to get to an objective truth here, and it's probably not fair to Judge Kavanaugh or to Christine Blasey Ford or Deborah Ramirez.
CBS congressional correspondent Nancy Cordes reporting from the Senate.
I was born in a trunk in the Princess Theater in Pocatello, Idaho. It was during a matinee on Friday, and they used a makeup towel for my daddy.
Met a young Tom Tangney in 1994, and I knew that kid was something special. I knew that one day, if he worked hard and reviewed his little heart out, he'd be on my show talking about movies every Friday. And here he is now with our Friday film review, A Star is Born.
A Star is Born for the umpteenth time. That was your brilliant producer, James. That was Judy Garland from the 1954 version of Star is Born. Long before the Barbra Streisand, Kris Kristofferson. That was very clever. And yes, Dave, I think I look up to you like Judy Garland looked up to James Mason, Barbra Streisand looked up to Kris Kristofferson. I love the parallel.
And now your star has completely surpassed mine.
Exactly.
I'm on the decline now.
And it's funny because there's really something elemental, I think, archetypal, mythic even, about the story arc of A Star is Born. And that's why Hollywood keeps coming back to it time and time again. A performer like Dave Ross at the top of his game, taking a newbie under his wing, and eventually that newbie surpasses him, climbing the ladder of stardom as he falls down it. Make them lovebirds too. We won't go that far. And you've got a guaranteed tragic romance. four times has this tale been told, the most recent being the Barbara Streisand, Kris Kristofferson version from the 70s. And now Bradley Cooper decides to make his directing debut with a fifth go-around, starring himself and another megastar, Lady Gaga. And like the other versions, this Star is Born is flashy, splashy, and a little bit trashy. Its soap opera elements are subsumed to some degree by the thrill of seeing two celebrities square off, and more importantly, by the power of the music. Now, since Cooper plays a rock star, the inevitable question is, can he sing? And the answer is a resounding yes.
Maybe it's time to look the old ways back. Maybe it's time to look the old ways back. Takes a lot to change, man. Hell, it takes a lot to try. Maybe it's time to live the old ways now.
Pretty good,
pretty
huh?
Good, yeah.
Why
did he issue some records?
Yeah.
He can't make any money on records anymore.
Yeah, maybe not. And since this is Lady Gaga's first starring role in a movie, the other inevitable question is, can she act? And the answer is absolutely. Now, of course, she's playing a budding singer, so it's not that big a stretch, but she holds her own with the oft-Oscar-nominated Cooper. It's also a little startling and refreshing, I've got to say, to see the unadulterated Gaga, sans costume and makeup. But the audiences are not going to flock to A Star is Born for the acting. It's the music scenes that should draw them in, and conveniently, they're the best scenes. One in a parking lot could be iconic. After meeting Cute in a bar, Jackson Maine, the character played by Bradley Cooper, and Allie, the character played by Lady Gaga, wind up in an empty parking lot in the middle of the night. Allie makes up a lyric on the spot.
Tell me something, boy. Aren't you tired trying to fill that void? Or do you need more? Ain't it hard keeping it so hardcore?
Is that me?
That's you.
You just write that now?
Yeah.
Pretty good.
Okay, so far so good. But then, more improbably, she just belts out another original. Again, this is all in a parking lot.
I started writing this song the other day. Maybe that could work, like as a chorus or something. I'm off the deep end. Watch as I dive in. I never meet the ground. Crash through the surface where they can't. We're far from the shallow now.
Okay, now, I think that sounds great, but it strains credulity, but it's all just setting up an emotional onstage moment a short time later when Maine drags an unsuspecting, supposedly, Allie on stage with him to belt out, you guessed it, that very parking lot song, this
band.
Time with a full band all accompaniment right. And even Jackson Maine. Exactly. Now, somehow these musical improbabilities are forgiven. They're a well-honored convention in musical theater, after all. But the rest of the movie is harder to swallow. Allie becomes too big a star way too fast, and Maine's ultimate demise seems too convenient and or contrived. It may guarantee an emotional wallop, but it feels unearned. I don't consider A Star is Born a traditional musical, since the singing only takes place on stages, but like a musical, its high points are the songs. The book of this near musical is too melodramatic for its own good, but the musical performances make A Star is Born worth watching, probably multiple times.
A Star is Born, the fifth remake. How many tangs?
I'm going to give it three. This is enjoyable, even though I don't think it's any great shakes.
Thank you, Tom.
Anytime.
And now, let's talk about getting places this weekend. Emergency road repairs are going to make it tough, and Chris Sullivan tells us which spots to avoid.
Yeah, usually we get a little bit more time to prepare for significant lane closures, but this time we're not so lucky. You want to avoid I-5 southbound out of Seattle tonight. The freeway is going to be reduced to just one lane at Spokane Street. Only the right lane is going to be open in that spot after about 8 o'clock tonight as workers make emergency repairs to an expansion joint and some damaged concrete. That's going to continue through tomorrow morning. Now, there is a possibility that the work could be pushed to tomorrow night if the forecasted rain keeps them from doing their work. And now for those of you heading east over I-90, you need to be prepared for emergency repair work near Cleyelum. It's not the drive over that's going to get you, but it's the return drive. The right lane of westbound I-90 is going to be closed near milepost 88. That's near Cleyelum. This is a weird one. There have been a bunch of accidents in that area, and engineers have found out that the pavement that they laid down there last year isn't as good as it should be when it comes to traction.
Mm-hmm.
The skid resistance is terrible. And so they need to actually re-grind the pavement there a little bit to make it safely.
Too smooth.
Yeah. So, and this pavement was laid about this time last year, and so the concrete was bad. And so it's actually led to a couple of accidents. And so there are some detour routes in place around Highway 97, but westbound drivers coming back from the east side, say any of those who are heading over to the Eastern Washington football game tomorrow, westbound delays should be pretty significant over the weekend. And it's going to stay in that configuration until they fix that concrete.
Wow. Okay. And the thing on near Spokane Street, didn't they fix those expansion joints?
Yeah, they do. They do. But every so often, they've got some more work to do on these. I'm not sure if this one was related to an accident or something but there's some concrete work to deal with and an expansion joint. This one's only one. But yeah, I mean, they redid all of them in the northbound direction not all that long ago. So those things keep popping up. And as you know, if they pop up during the drive, that's bad news.
Time for a Sports Insider, subject to interruption at any moment. Sponsored by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Here he is, Danny O'Neill.
Hi, Dave.
What's your vote?
My vote is, we should limit our discussion of news to make way for sports.
Yeah, okay.
That's my vote.
I second.
facing L.A. on Sunday, this is the big test, right?
Well, I don't even know if it's a test so much as a potential drubbing in the waiting. The Rams came here last year and kicked the Seahawks' teeth in, 42-7. Mm-hmm. It was the end of an era. It was brutal. It was bitter. And I don't think it's gotten any closer since then. I don't think it's going to be a 35-point loss.
Hey, did I see that Russell Wilson's injured?
Yeah, not really. He's got a hamstring issue, but it's not keeping him from practicing. He's fine.
Okay.
Easy for me to say, right? It's not my hamstring. Yeah, but he's not. He's not.
Is it true? I just read he has never missed a snap.
He's been taken out of games. Yeah, he's not missed a practice. Is that right? Yeah, I think he's practiced at least to some extent, and he's never missed a start. He's made every start in his career, but he's come out of games.
Huh. All right, so who do you watch out for on the LA side? Everybody or
Ndamukong Suh, because you got to keep a good close eye on him because he'll stomp on you. He'll also kick you in the ding ding. That's something that he's been known to do from time to time.
Is that like pinning your ears back?
Yeah, well, this is a little bit different than that. And yesterday they were practicing, the Rams were practicing on legally hitting the quarterback, and he came up and he just threw a punch and like socked the dummy, and it went back about 10 feet.
You're not allowed to do that.
No, you're definitely not.
I mean, you can do it to a dummy, but you can't.
Yeah, and they were practicing hitting the quarterback without getting a penalty, and he just came and hit the guy with a heart punch.
Huh. So do they practice here?
No. I saw it on video.
I saw it on the Twitters. I see. So that's just a little psychological
or him just showing,
psyops operation.
Or him just showing his inner menace. He did stomp on an opponent.
By the way, is that a thing now? Do they put up videos designed to intimidate the other team?
No. Not usually. Usually it's reporters putting up videos that they think will go viral.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
That's the new hot thing. That's what's hot on these streets these days, Dave.
Huh. Well, that's social media.
You also got to watch Aaron Donald, who's got two first names. And Aaron Donald doesn't sound that intimidating. He's also terrifying. He practiced in the offseason with a trainer who was holding knives. Like,
what?
Sitting there fending off. Like,
hang on a second.
Yeah.
So this guy's on the offensive line?
Defensive tackle.
Defensive tackle. and he practices against a guy with knives.
Guy was holding knives, and he was practicing warding off what they call hand fighting at the line of scrimmage, and the coach was holding knives. And
Don't you get 15 yards for knifing the opposition now?
You're definitely not allowed to bring a knife onto the field, but you would figure that I don't want any part of a guy who practices against someone holding knives, who just does that for fun. Part of the readiness. And if that's not enough, they also got Michael Brockers. So they got three meat eaters up front.
So you're saying they can't have knives on the field?
No.
This is the sissification of football.
No, incorrect. Yeah, that would be called a foreign object. There was at no point that was legal.
That was never legal?
No, not even the Raiders were allowed to do that.
Wow. All right, so I guess it's time for your prediction now.
Well, it's not going to be a good prediction, so can we just skip it?
No. I tell you what, since it's not going to be a good prediction, why don't you tell us what goes into you making predictions?
Oh, I come up with two numbers and assign them to the different teams and just go from it there.
No, that's not true. There's a careful analysis that goes into this because you used to be a newspaper guy.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to, isn't it like betting on the horses where you assess the injuries, you assess the weather, the state of the field, the psychological profiles of the players, and then you award points to different teams?
It is a wild guess. If anybody was really good at forecasting outcomes, they would be millionaires over betting.
So
on sports.
So in other words, when I hear you on the pregame show guessing the outcome of the game, it is strictly that. You're just throwing numbers at the wall.
It's my best guess, but it's a guess, and the accuracy of it is probably like 20-30%. First game, the first home game, I predicted the Seahawks would win 24-20. They won 24-13.
That's pretty good.
It's pretty close. Yeah. The Cowboys had the ball late and they fumbled it, but that's about as good as it gets. You very rarely hit it square on the nose, and I would say that I'm probably about 80% in picking the winner in Seahawks games, but that's not a great stat considering how often they've won over the past 3 or 4 years.
Okay, so they are playing at home against an undefeated team who's got with a guy who practices with knives. What's the score going to be?
Rams 33, Seahawks 23. There, are you happy?
Oh, my gosh.
There, are you happy?
That's going to be humiliating.
Yeah, it's not going to be good. The Rams are favored by 7. The Seahawks have one of the worst offenses in the league, and the Rams have the best offense. Yeah, I'm not looking. The Seahawks are missing 3 starters on defense. That's not good.
All right. What I can predict is that the Yays are 51 and the Nays are 49, and so cloture passes, and it goes on to confirmation in the Senate. How about that?
Now, that would indicate that the Republicans have lost none of the key senators, Senate votes. 51-49 is also the majority that they hold in the Senate.
Republicans have won this one. That's because they practice against people who are armed with knives.
Yeah?
Yeah. Our Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealer. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Go Hawks anyway. The Seattle City Council is analyzing how it's spending its money to end homelessness. But Kyra's Hannah Scott says that the homeless not always getting that money. I mean, what did they discover here?
No, the city council has been looking for answers on homeless spending, and they're not always getting those answers. So the mayor proposed her budget more than a week ago, which includes just under $90 million to address the homeless crisis. Now, about half of that goes to shelters, villages, the navigation team, hygiene centers, and things of that nature. That mayor's proposal increases homeless spending from this year by about $3 million, so it's not a huge increase. The city council has been trying to get a deeper look at how all of that money has been used in 2018 and whether it's been doing any good before it signs off on the mayor's proposal, and it's at times been a challenge. The council took a deep dive and a full day of meetings this week focused just on homeless spending, grilling city staff from various departments. But concrete answers were hard to come by, and Councilmember Shama Sawant was frustrated.
We see a lot of recycled information in every presentation. And yet, despite all of that, when we ask basic questions, we're always told, well, we don't know the what, where, how. I mean, I just don't understand how this is possible and how much time the public should see the city council continue to just regurgitating information as if we're doing something useful while the housing crisis and the homelessness crisis is raging out there.
And she's not wrong. There's a series of meetings I've watched over the last couple of weeks where we've seen a lot of the same information coming from the Human Services Department and about the navigation team and things like that. So I get the frustration. And she wasn't the only council member who had it. Now, these meetings that I'm talking about that came in the full day came one day after the city auditor released a report that, among other things, questioned why the city keeps spending on basic shelters when a lot of people don't take up the navigation team on their offers when they're in them, and instead urged the city to focus more on enhanced shelters and villages that are 24/7. They have case management, storage, and that appears to be the mayor's plan, with those enhanced shelters getting five times more people into what's known as permanent housing rather as opposed to the basic shelters. The auditor's report also urged the city to look at bridge-to-housing structures. Those are large sprung tents with up to hundreds of beds that have heat, water, and services. They have them in San Diego, L.A., and I think Sacramento or San Francisco are about to use them. But the new navigation team head, Fred Podesta, warned while those may be more efficient, they may not be the right solution for Seattle's homelessness crisis.
Seeing kind of our past uptake and acceptance of offers of shelter, I think we'd need to go carefully to think about, are people going to accept an enormous 150-person dormitory that's in one big tent? And so, you know, we'd have to think about the design again, because we've seen different results with different kinds of offers. So before we get too bound up in the efficiency of a particular structure type, I think we really have to think about how our clients will react to it.
So he's essentially concerned that people living on the streets aren't going to be willing to go to those. That is not good enough for Councilmember Teresa Mosqueda.
We're tired of people thinking about it. You mentioned the word think, I think, three times. We know that there's examples from other cities, and L.A. is a great example, and I don't mean to be disparaging, Director, but we don't have time to think about it anymore, especially when we have examples of other cities that have already looked at what's going on well.
But now I'm getting confused here. You're saying some of the shelters the homeless people don't want to go to. So these are the big shelters with the mattresses on the ground?
That is, again, Fred Podesta, who's now the new leader of the navigation team. He said, basically talking to his outreach folks who are out on the street, that they've heard from some of the folks out living in encampments and places like that, that they would be not necessarily willing to go into a big dormitory type of situation, which is kind of what these big giant sprung tents are. You're 150, 200 people living all under one tent, that they prefer being in their own tent or in a tiny house village or something along those lines.
Right. But at some point, don't you have to say you're not allowed to be in your own tent, so you're going to be in the dormitory tent?
And so that was another big thing that came up also in this meeting, is the enforcement question. Teresa Mosqueda had recently visited in L.A. and someone else had been to the San Diego one, where they have a focus on enforcement, someone said, and they wanted to know, the council members, what exactly that meant. And what that means is you got to follow our rules. You got to be in this tent. You can't be sleeping on our streets. So that doesn't seem to be necessarily something that we would see here. Again, this is all a lot of discussion at this point. But I think what the navigation team head was saying is that we need to look into this before we spend any money on making that tent, make sure people will go to it. But then you have to get that enforcement, maybe make them go.
Right. So in the city, now you mentioned L.A. has the big tents, the big dormitory tents.
San Diego already has them. L.A. is also doing them.
And so do they compel people to go there or else, basically?
Yes. In San Diego.
All right. So that's what they're saying. Yeah. So when they find a tent under a freeway overpass, they say, we have a shelter tent for you, but you cannot stay here.
Mm-hmm.
We're not saying you have to be unsheltered. We're not, condemning you to live outside, but we're taking your tent down and you're going to live in the dormitory tent.
Yes.
That's what they say.
Yes.
Okay.
All of this, though, really quickly, Budget Director Ben Noble for the city warned, we don't have enough money to make all of these enhanced shelter beds. We don't have enough resources for affordable housing and all of that. So it's definitely still a work in progress.
All right. Thank you.
You bet.
Carrie is Hannah Scott. This is Seattle's Morning News. There are still some things we don't know about the hacking of the 2016 election, and that's what Kathleen Hall Jamison has taken on. She teaches communication at the University of Pennsylvania, and she's written a book called Cyber War, How Russian Hackers and Trolls Helped Elect a President. And Kathleen, was there something about the Russian intervention that rises beyond what normal, everyday, unorganized trolls could do if they want to affect an election?
Yes. What surprised me as I did the research for this book was the extent to which the trolls, that is the people marauding around in cyberspace, as opposed to the hackers who stole Democratic content. What I was surprised about the trolls was the extent to which they had a clear theory of the election. It wasn't just cacophony. And they aligned with themes that were central to the Trump rhetoric. They aligned with the audience needs, that is the groups that he needed to mobilize, demobilize, and shift. And they used evocative visual content, much of it simply repurposed from what they found within the U.S. in the more extreme conservative sites. But that was evidence of an organized effort that was actually highly strategic. And I was surprised at how strategic it was. I didn't expect to find that.
How did they gain? They must have had an intimate knowledge then of American culture to pull this off convincingly. Where'd that come from?
Yeah, and that's the second really interesting question. If you pay any attention at all to media, you will learn which states are in contention, which voting groups need to be mobilized, where the worries about turnout are. And I quote in the book, extended passages from things that are online, that are our press, hence available to anyone who speaks English within the global web, that essentially give you a guidebook. And that's way number one. Way number two is we know the Russians stole voter data. They stole turnout models. And we also learned that they had the complete democratic voter plan as part of one of the hacks. We learned that from the last Mueller indictment. We do know it was in Russian hands. And so that's a second possibility. So apart from being able to read about it and then also figure it out because you've got some democratic content that is telling you how the campaigns are strategizing, you also have a scenario in which the social media platforms make it really easy to find voter groups because they're really set up to sell us to advertisers. And so the demographic categories, once you know what they are pretty easy to reach by social media.
Right. But, I mean, the political consultants have access to all this, too. In fact, they originate a lot of it. So what's the difference between the Russians exploiting this material to affect the election and the parties themselves exploiting this material to affect the election?
That's a really important question. And the argument that I make in the book is that differences in amount of material matter. So essentially, they are aligned with the Trump messaging. And had the same messaging come in from the U.S., it simply would have been more messaging on behalf of Trump legitimately placed there. But when you increase the amount of content and it's more negative than it otherwise would be, you can shift votes on the margin. You don't get massive effects out of it, but you can shift votes on the margin. And we saw that in work that I did on the 2000 election, which, as you know, was closer than this one,
right,
where we showed that changing in amounts of messaging could make a difference to account for why one candidate won the popular vote and the other won the Electoral College. So by changing the amount and the amount of negativity, they could plausibly create this effect. And as a result, if you take all of the stupid things that Hillary Clinton's campaign did and all of the dexterous or stupid things that Donald Trump's campaign did, and you bake them all in and then ask, could that change in the amount have affected 78,000 votes? The answer is, if they got it to the right demographic groups in three states, it could. But we don't have the information to know whether they did that. The platforms know that, and I wish they'd tell us that. We do know that the hacked content reached voters across the United States, largely with the complicity of our media.
And that's what this boiled down to, that 78,000 votes.
In three states.
In three states. Well, I mean, sunspots could have changed that, right? That's tiny.
Yeah. When people try to explain the election, there are all sorts of things you could say could have changed the outcome. Hillary Clinton could have gone to those states.
Yeah.
Hillary Clinton could have not said deplorables. Hillary Clinton could not have said it was allergies when it was instead pneumonia. All of those things are already baked in my set of assumptions. And the question is, if all of those are there, if everything else is exactly the same, and you add the trolls and you change the message balance in the computers of some individuals aligned with Trump's messaging, and in the hacked intervention, you change the agenda in the media so that things happen in media that couldn't have happened without the hacking, is that enough to swing that number of votes? And the answer I came to, and it surprised me because I didn't see all of this put together before I did the research, was there's enough change in the media agenda and in the content of the last two debates to say that if everything else is a constant, there's enough of a stimulus there to actually make the difference. It's not a certain case. It's a case that says it seems to me to be pretty likely.
University of Pennsylvania researcher Kathleen Hall Jamieson. Her book is called Cyber War.